Hello and welcome to Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong speaking to you from here in Istanbul. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and its region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it. Don't forget Turkey Book Talk's new membership system for listeners. If you want extra benefits and content while also supporting the podcast, then do consider becoming a member. If you sign up as a paying member, you'll get access to full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. You'll also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive in English, which amounts to almost 60 conversations so far. Most of these transcripts were previously published at the Hürriyet Daily News, but from now on, a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access them. The archive also includes many interviews not previously published on the podcast. As a member, you will also get access to a special 30% discount on Turkey and Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. They have a fantastic archive of titles and have kindly made over 200 books from their Turkey and Ottoman history series available at cut price, exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members through a special discount code. I've previously hosted a number of IB Taurus authors on the podcast, so becoming a member is obviously a great way to get more acquainted with their work. So do consider signing up. If you do become a member, you'll be helping us develop the podcast, and if more members sign up, we'll ultimately be able to start publishing a new episode every week, up from the current one episode every 2 weeks. To become a Turkey Book Talk member, you just have to pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. At present, we post new episodes bi-weekly, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. And if we end up becoming able to publish a new episode every week, then that will go up to $12 monthly maximum, which is not a bad deal, I hope you'll agree. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then everything helps and you'll certainly be more than welcome. But so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members are only charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. The aim of the membership system is to turn Turkey Book Talk into a completely sustainable, reliable, and wide-ranging source, providing a bigger platform for even more authors, journalists, and researchers to get the word out about their work. In the long run, I also want to develop our website and potentially branch out further into Turkish language content, but to do that we need your support, so do consider taking advantage of this new membership system. You can find all the details of how to sign up via armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com or through any of the other Turkey Book Talk pages. But now, on with our latest episode. In it, we welcome Ceren Baysan of University of California, Berkeley. She joins us to discuss her very interesting new research paper called Can More Information Lead to More Voter Polarization? Experimental Evidence from Turkey. The study was based on voter surveys in the months before the April 2017 referendum on granting President Erdogan even more executive powers. In it, Baysan not only measures Turkish voters' opinions about various issues, but also the major party's own polling operations, how much they know about voters' preferences, and how they adapt their work in light of that information. The report is full of interesting insights about the state of Turkish parties, politics, and the deep polarization that is only getting worse in the country. We talk about those things later on, but I started by asking Ceren Baysan, first of all, to reflect on the experience of carrying out the research. Was there anything particularly notable or surprising worth mentioning straight out?
I guess the first point of surprise was that when I touched base with them about going forth with the project that I had already kind of laid out to them beforehand, there was no hesitation that I could indeed go to parliament and do the work. I basically reached out to all the politicians that I could in the constituencies or the provinces, rather, where I had done the voter survey myself in October of 2016. You know, what do you know about voters? Where do you get this information from? How much does your party invest in it? And then I asked very detailed questions about what they thought that their voters believed about certain issues, all the way from, do you support the state of emergency, things on religion and gender equality, the mega project, like the large infrastructure projects, redistribution and welfare programs. And so I would ask the politicians how they think that their voters respond to the questions. And then I would ask them their own position on each issue. And I learned so much. But what was incredible was that I had permission to go almost every day for about 3 months. So this intersected with the budgetary period. This intersected with the period when they were first inquiring to go to a referendum within the parliament. This intersected with the, I don't know the exact terminology in English, but the legal age to marry and the laws regarding sexual assault of minors, as well as, you know, the actual voting procedure to go to the referendum. So it was a sensational period. And I think what I definitely could feel is that, you know, some politicians were taking the punches as they came, as in it was very reactionary. I think for some politicians, it's hard to maintain a long-term vision and be strategic about what they're doing because so much is happening in Turkey. Just as voters are affected by the tumultuous period and all these events going on, the politicians are too.
You were based in Ankara, but you were conducting this research across the country, really. I mean, how many provinces did you take in overall?
So I was doing the interviews within parliament. It is often the case that the MPs will go to their own constituencies a number of days of the week, but that they're expected to be in parliament. I believe it was Tuesdays and Thursdays, because that's when they have the plenary sessions and voting procedures. And then for the voter survey, I did this with jointly with Konda, and it was a pleasure to work with them. And the way that they operate is that they have surveyors across the country, and so they mobilize their surveyors before the survey is planned. And we did it in, I believe, 11 constituencies. So southeastern Turkey, which included Diyarbakir, Mardin, Urfa, and Van. And then the three separate constituencies within Istanbul. So Istanbul 1, 2, and 3. And then the Mediterranean region. So Adana, Mersin, Hatay, and Antalya. And I spent a lot of time speaking to voters in different regions as well, in southeastern Turkey, and then in the Mediterranean region and in Istanbul, just to test out the questions. And I also spoke to local researchers about past surveys that have been done in Turkey. And that was one way in which I formulated the survey.
And obviously the survey covered a wide range of issues, but I mean, could you just kind of summarize a little bit, like, what were the headline kind of figures that you found? What kind of differences did you notice between the parties?
I mean, given that I use a quantitative method, my sample size was not large enough to really rigorously state the differences on different policy issues. But one anecdotally, what was quite true was that the incumbent party, for example, and this is kind of common knowledge among polling companies and many people in Turkey, is that the incumbent has for years invested heavily in learning about voter policy preferences. They are continuously collecting data on the sentiments and preferences of voters. And the opposition party simply does not do this, the main opposition party. And that was clear, you know, this was just clear from the conversations that I had. And it was explicitly said that this was true. You know, again, I cannot rigorously state why the opposition does not. But what I was curious about was, once I sent this information to the politicians, would they respond? Is it something that, okay, they might not invest in, but even if they were given like subsidized information, is it something that they would value, or are they just playing a different game? And so when I sent the information, I did not think that the incumbent would be affected by it, because it is certainly the case that whatever I sent them is unlikely to be better information than what they have access to. And that's the case. They didn't respond to the information. But the opposition, when I sent the information, about 25% of the MPs that I sent it to responded. And they said they want to know more about voters. And that's what actually led to the door-to-door campaign. But secondly, when I analyzed their tweets, their behavior on Twitter, I could see that they started tweeting more about the topics that had been covered in the report. And I think what's interesting to know, and I think this is kind of a conundrum that other parties have faced in other countries, is that, for example, the opposition in Turkey does talk quite a bit about human rights and civil liberties and things like this. And these are, of course, very important topics. But when you survey the voters, leaders. As a basic example, many of them support the state of emergency and they support the arrests made during the state of emergency because they really care about terrorism and national security. And I think it's just a question as to whether or not when you think about electoral competition and you think about competition between political parties, can one side really contest effectively for votes when they're picking a platform that may not reflect the preferences of the voters? It's not clear to me. I don't have an answer to that. But what I did notice is that when I sent the report and they learned that voters are not adamantly against these arrests or the state of emergency and really care about the economy and terrorism, you know, they started talking more about the economy and terrorism on Twitter. It is difficult to say exactly what was happening, but I was interested to find that they did respond to the information.
It's very interesting. I mean, wonder if you could just speculate a little bit about what you think the reason is why there's this big gulf, because I think it's quite common knowledge, really, that the AKP really does poll obsessively every month after every event, after every, you know, terror attack. They're constantly taking the pulse of voters and shifting accordingly, you know, shifting rhetoric, shifting policies. We've seen it recently with the rhetoric around Afrin. Erdogan's constantly talking about sending Syrians home or hinting at it. Because I think they've started to notice that this is an issue that Turkish voters are pretty united on. They're really starting to take against Syrian refugees in Turkey. And it's possible to speculate on that being a result of this kind of really close polling that they do. And as you mentioned in the report, it's quite clear that the CHP doesn't do the same kind of rigorous polling. You mentioned there, you talk about resources, but this goes back many years as well. I wonder if you could just kind of speculate a little bit more on why is there this big difference between the two when it comes to approaches to polling?
So I think that, for example, AK Parti's entrance into politics had to come through mobilizing a large voter base. You know, they didn't come into politics the same way that the current opposition originally came into politics. So I think early on, they were interested in, you know, leveraging the fact that they thought that they could appeal to the average voter, or what we call the median voter. And my sense is that early on, they were investing in learning about voters. And one, I think the main opposition party was slow on understanding the importance of that and coordinating to do that. And it is the case that I believe this was around 2005 that the current incumbent party reinstated an article in the Constitution that state funding for the political parties is proportional to vote share. So the incumbent has had more than double the funding as any other party for a long time. And of course, the opposition parties have not been coordinating at all to amass their resources. And I think what happens is that over time, if you see that this party is investing immensely in doing something and you're not able to coordinate with others and you know that you have significantly lower resources, you might not think that it's your best strategy to even play that game, as in you're not going to be able to catch up no matter what you do. And honestly, I think one does have to ask what's happening with the leaders of the opposition party. I mean, they're the ones making that decision. So for example, let's say that they did compete hard and they started contesting for votes more effectively, they would get into trouble and they might be hesitant. I mean, for years, the democratic procedure into electing leaders of the main opposition party is not that democratic. And so you might just have leaders who are fine staying in power and not contesting for votes effectively if it means any risk to them. Again, that's speculation. And I cannot say. It's a very difficult position to be in. But one has to ask, you know, what is the effect of not having a democratic procedure to elect the party leader? Does that person have an incentive to do anything? And another point is that the one thing that I can say with more certainty in regards to the project that I did is that we see that contesting for votes is difficult. If people are polarized, you can't just go and target what we call a moderate or a potential swing voter. You have to have a very nuanced understanding of who to target and who to affect. If people are polarized and if you send out a blanket message, you'll face some backlash and also gain some votes. And so it makes it very tricky. And all that is to say is that this game of trying to move votes or contest for votes in the direction that you want is very complicated and requires a huge investment. So it's not like a marginal decision. You can't say, oh, let's just try a little bit more. You have to make an upfront investment and decide that's what you're going to do. And I think that there just may have been some hesitation from from the opposition, and they were late in that game. And the incumbent kind of was the first mover on this model, and it's been the basis of what they do. But now that's not to say that everything that they do is necessarily motivated by voters. So for example, the EU decision, like this, the support for Turkey joining the EU, if you poll voters, at least when I polled voters, it was quite 50-50. And so when something's 50-50, I think that the incumbent, that's something that they want to keep careful track of, but that they might have leniency in terms of guiding the dialogue. So they might be able to affect the rhetoric. And I think that it wouldn't surprise me if many scholars, you know, view that the methods put forth by political parties around the world, including Turkey, as people that use their resources to also affect the dialogue. So for example, the Kurdish issue, if you poll voters on that issue, it has evolved over time. There was a time when it was 50-50, and it's, you know, it's been tilting 60-40 most recently. So that's if something 60-40, 70-30, when if there's a strong majority on one issue, as you said with the Afrin case, it's something that you're going to be affected by the voters.
You referenced there the difference in the backgrounds of the parties. And I think it's really important to kind of stress that as well, personally. Like, right. It's really important to look at the heritage of the AKP and its various kind of Islamist party predecessors. They've always had this very grassroots kind of ground up heritage. And they actually almost pride themselves on this kind of bottom up neighborhood to neighborhood network, really, across the whole country. And of course, you know, their predecessors really took root in the local administrations, in municipalities and running the major cities. First of all, and of course that kind of heritage gives them this almost ingrained culture of kind of close canvassing of voters. So now that they're in the center of power and they've been there for over 15 years, there's this kind of reinforcing cycle because they're there at the center, but they've also got this kind of heritage of local activism and mobilized, you know, really motivated local activists and whatnot. So they've got both the advantages of being at the center, but also this kind of institutional cultural background where they're very engaged on the grassroots level. It makes for a very kind of effective political operation, really, almost an uncontestable one in a way.
Yes, I agree. I think that now that that's the case and that they've been doing that rigorously for such a long time, it's difficult for the main opposition party. But, you know, a lot of people have put energy into opposing the incumbent. But I am curious about what about the mobilization against your own party to make it catch up with the times, to make it competitive? You know, the thing that people might say is that, look, it's just too hard. I cannot say myself whether that's true or not, but I agree with the point that you made. There's this, we could say that it's a difference in culture that has its roots way back when.
Whenever I get on this subject, there's a book that I always refer to. It's it was published a few years ago in English. Mm-hmm. It was written by a political scientist called Kayahan Delibash. I think it was called Islamist Mobilization in Turkey. It was either that or the Grassroots of Political Islam. I'll put a link anyway on the website.
Yes.
And he conducted his research actually in the 90s. So it was before the AKP was even founded. I think it was with the Refah Party back in the 90s. And he really did do this extremely extensive research where he was going kind of on these neighborhood tours with the activists on the grassroots level. And he was seeing them working door to door and seeing how they responded to voters and how they were almost doing this kind of activism that wasn't even political in a way, or it wasn't looking for immediate political rewards. They were filling the space of social services that the old leftist parties used to provide before the 1980 coup. And then when they were kind of wiped out by that coup, there was a big vacuum that had to be filled on the urban periphery. And most of the time, the parties that stepped into that were these new fledgling Islamist parties. And the AKP is just the kind of inheritor of that thing. It was a really fascinating study that I'd definitely recommend to anybody listening, really. I'll put a link on the website. I don't know if you've seen his work as well.
No, I would. I would love to read that. And I think honestly, a lot of the sociologists are the perfect reference on this point. Because again, you know, the questions that the quantitative scholars attack are affected by what data is available. And I think an issue like this, it's not easily observable, but it's certainly something that happened. And sociologists, when they know that this trend is occurring, then they can give us the background on that process. I think also there's a sociologist at Berkeley, Jihan Tual, and he's also talked about Islamic mobilization.
Now, kind of moving on a bit about the kind of results that you found in the survey, you found some kind of interesting things about perceptions of the economy, because,
right,
you know, we've obviously still got these very high growth rates in Turkey, but there's been a lot of talk about how the economy seems to be a growing problem for a lot of voters. You know, people are more and more concerned about it. You know, they're worried about the cost of living. Inflation is still very high. Unemployment's still high. Personal debt is getting worse, apparently. So there are all these kind of worries about the way things are going. And you refer in the report to how different constituencies kind of respond to these different developments. Just wonder if you could talk about that. Like, you make the point, probably unsurprisingly really, but supporters of Erdogan and the AKP tend to attribute poor economic conditions, outside forces, you know, the attempted coup, kind of foreign powers trying to sabotage the economy, whereas opposition voters tend to put the blame squarely at the door of the government. So I wonder if you could just kind of reflect a bit on this issue of the economy and how different voters of different perspectives respond to these apparently mounting concerns about this issue, and possibly going forward, like if the economy continues to struggle, how voters may respond to these kind of conditions.
Yeah, I think this is, at least for me personally, having spent time on this project, this is something that I'm most interested in, because I think it's incredibly important. So one, this result on, for example, voters blaming either what I call external factors outside the incumbent's control for poor economic conditions, that comes from a survey this question I did not ask in my survey, and I found out about it, and it was a survey that was funded by a U.S. firm. And I cannot disclose it, which firm it is, but that result is actually what motivated me to design the implementation of the campaign so that I could possibly detect this backlash that could occur. And the basic idea is that, you know, in 2016 or something, the global terrorism database that collects attacks, terrorist attacks around the world, Turkey had 500 or so terrorist attacks in 2015 or 2016. So you do have these external threats that are going on. And Turkey has a history of a rhetoric about foreign powers and how it affects the country, going back to the founding of the republic. And again, this is speculative, but it's something that I would love to put more time into my research into understanding, is that while the parties in any country, again, might purposefully use a rhetoric where they emphasize the role of foreign powers or external threats, or what's happening in the U.S., we have to also, I think, maybe this is too giving, but I do think we need to allow it to be the case that some voters truly believe this is true. And there are events in history within Turkey where it is simply a fact that external factors have affected their well-being within the country. So it's not outlandish for someone to be able to leverage that dynamic. Then, on the other hand, you are going to have voters who say, no, that those external threats or those external factors are precisely due to the government. And so what I suggest in the paper, again, this is a suggestion, is that these voters are split on an issue that is very difficult to prove. It's very difficult to prove exactly who is to blame. And what I'm curious about is what you pointed out, which is that, let's say that there were even more terrorist attacks, or let's say that the value of the lira plummets even more. Do these voters start to convert in their beliefs? For example, there's research on how the way in which people update their beliefs is affected by the frequency of certain events. So if they don't know what is to blame, but then they start seeing a change in the frequency, or they get signals at a certain frequency, they might start to converge. But on the other hand, they might actually start to polarize further. So that's why I think it's important to know that as economic conditions get worse, or as national security gets worse, we should track how voters in Turkey are updating their views. If they're becoming more and more polarized, I really do think that is worrisome. So, and to answer your question, I don't know which one is going to happen. One, it does depend on how things go economically in Turkey. I think that as we get closer to this election and this war that's going on in at the border of Turkey continues, things will most likely get worse, if I had to make a speculation. And I would not be surprised if people become more polarized. I think, again, as things get worse, it's not surprising that some people think the best policy is to just increase the power of one side, of their side.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about other examples of, in other countries where, you know, you can find examples on either side, really. You know, there are examples where economic trouble, you'd imagine, would hit the popularity of a leader, but in fact, it's had the opposite effect. It's had a kind of rallying effect behind them. You know, if you think about something like Russia, you know, for the last few years, there's been a kind of stagnation in the Russian economy, mainly due to oil prices, actually, but people are really suffering, and it doesn't seem to have hit Putin's popularity. In fact, it's only risen in surveys and whatnot. So obviously, there are foreign policy issues there as well that are helping rally support for him. So I don't know, there's kind of examples on either side, I suppose. Just a speculation on my part, like, I think if the economy really did tank, I can't see a lot of people changing their minds about what the causes behind that are. You know, the people who subscribe to the government's narrative on things, you know, they're not going to just change their mind about these things. You know, they've already bought into this this kind of narrative, so it seems unlikely that they would change their mind at this stage.
Yeah, it could be. And I think, though, in the case of Turkey, it is quite interacted with the fact that there is conflict, like real conflict, and that this makes people particularly tense and maybe even more and more willing to buy into the rhetoric of the government. And honestly, we call this rhetoric, but I think, you know, if you were to interview politicians from the incumbent side, they would be willing to have a long and an intense conversation with you that they really do think that what, you know, that they are after the best policy that's for the welfare of the country. And that's not necessarily the view of just the top leaders. I don't know. I just really think that there is a component of this that is difficult. I mean, other countries have pursued similar policies before. So that's the part that, and in the case of Russia, what I don't know, for example, is, again, I agree with you that it's not really affecting the voters. I don't know if the voters are as polarized. Again, you know, if there's this distinction. And I think part of what affects that, and which is true in Turkey, is that these threats are real. The war is there. These small rogue groups are around. And voters don't know what those parties would do to deal with these issues. They just don't know. So that's the other difficulty, I think. But yeah, I'm with you. If I had to put money on it, I'd assume that voters will just become more polarized. And if you look at the result in the paper about the voters being asked who is most responsible for the latest devaluation of the Turkish lira, the incumbent voters on average have a very strong opinion. And it's actually the opposition voters that, while most of them believe it's the president and the government, even among them, a significant proportion attribute it to these external factors. So the distribution is skewed in favor of the incumbent on this dimension.
Yeah, that's interesting. Bringing things to a conclusion, really. I mean, we're talking here about polarization, and obviously it would be wrong to kind of go through this conversation without reflecting on the kind of recent developments politically about this new alliance system that is going to get brought in. So the AKP and the Nationalist Movement Party, the MHP, have kind of joined together. They were campaigning during the referendum effectively together for the yes vote, and they've really formalized that alliance now, and they've just in the process of passing the legislation necessary through parliament to allow them to formally align ahead of the next election. And it just does seem to me that this institutionalization of this alliance, it's really polarization is just going to get more pronounced, because the AKP and the MHP, their base really does have a very strong shared kind of identity, shared social background, and shared there's this kind of famous cultural polarization in Turkey, but the AKP and the MHP are really on one side of that divide. And this kind of new alliance system is—it seems likely to just make that polarization more pronounced. It seems. I don't know if you could just kind of reflect on how this new alliance system could, going forward, perhaps exacerbate polarization even more than it is already.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, again, this is something that's difficult for me to provide a sharp insight on, because I agree that this could lead to further polarization. But if, you know, these parties represent half of Turkey, then the other parties have to represent the other half, and they have to find a way to do that. You know, in the case of the U.S., for example, for years, you had two parties representing two halves of the U.S., and all elections are pretty much 50-50. And the distinction between the parties was often blurred because they're supposed to be competing for this median voter, and they find a way to do that. So one, is it possible for the other parties to represent the other half in whatever strategic way possible? They don't have to have a formal alliance, but just to make sure that each takes a platform that represents this remaining segments of the population and coordinate on that. But I think a more simple response to what you've pointed out is I would have to agree that that's true. But I think that's just because they're going to continue to dominate.
And you obviously conducted your research during the referendum. Presumably you were in Turkey when the referendum result was announced. I don't know, having conducted this research, were you surprised by the referendum result and the aftermath? Or was it something that you were expecting it to be close, and were you expecting the kind of fraud allegations afterwards to come out? And just wondering if you could just kind of reflect on the results of the referendum last year.
I thought that, to be honest, as soon as the coup attempt happened, or like maybe a month after it, before the referendum was even announced, I thought that there would be a referendum. And I think many people did, because, you know, it's something that the incumbent party has been after for some time. And Erdogan's ratings went skyrocketed right after the coup attempt. And again, that didn't surprise me, because again, it's important to note that people, after they experience something like that, they want a strong leadership. But what was interesting to me, at least, was that while his ratings were very high immediately after the coup attempt, we saw that polls actually this time, in contrast to the November 2016 election, were not too far off. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I do, from what I recall, the couple of months leading up to the referendum, it was expected to be close. Again, the polling companies this time were careful to say that they faced a lot of uncertainty, because there's a lot of people stating that they wouldn't declare how they attend to vote, or that they were uncertain. But my view was affected by the polls. Like they said that it was probably going to be 50-50, and that kind of conditioned me as we got closer. And then no, I was not at all surprised about the aftermath. Once you got that yes vote, and there's a lot of mistrust within the institutions, and so the fact that they want to try to control as much as possible is not at all surprising to me.
That was Ceren Baysan. Many thanks to her. I've put a link to the report we were discussing up at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, or you can just Google it. Don't forget to consider joining the new Turkey Book Talk membership system to help support the podcast going forward. The deal we offer is not bad value at all. If you pledge a minimum of $3 per episode, you'll get access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every episode as it's published, as well as transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, and also exclusive access to a special 30% discount on a selection of over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. You'll be helping Turkey Book Talk to keep the show on the road, developing further and providing a bigger platform for our guests and their work. Find links with information on how to sign up on all the Turkey Book Talk websites. Please also spare a minute to rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever podcast platform you listen on. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes, and you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening. Seçtiğim sensin, bütün dünyayı.